Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
We don't have cyclists in Copenhagen. We only have Copenhageners on bikes. So those people, the regular citizens, they're not going to do stuff if it's dangerous. So if they're doing it out there now, it's because it's not.
Cities have never been so vibrant, vital and on the move. But what is the formula for a city that really works? True, there's no one-size-fits-all method, but there is one basic tenet. The neighbourhood and its street life are a good starting point. On today's show, we look at some of our favourite urban projects that are transforming their cities and offer a model for how to build happier communities. That's all ahead in the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's episode. Today we're cracking open the pages of the July-August issue of Monocle magazine, where we feature 20 of our favourite urban projects around the world. And we start with a mode of transportation that is perhaps enjoying a bit of a revival in current times. Bicycles have long been touted as the answer to many metropolises' transport woes. They're nimble, require minimal infrastructure, and offer a means of getting around that can enhance our experience of city life. For many years, Copenhagen has been the model of good bicycle urbanism, something that the Danish-Canadian urbanist Michael Colville Andersen knows all too well. He founded Copenhagenize Design Company in 2007, a planning consultancy inspired by the transport offerings in the city that he calls home. He's also host of the Canadian-produced television series The Life-Sized City. Monocle's Nick Manise caught up with Colville Andersen to discuss the development of Copenhagen as a bicycle mecca, its transport infrastructure, and the psychology of getting people to take to two wheels.
Well, there's two cities. There's Copenhagen and Frederiksberg. For you, it doesn't matter. It's all the same, you know, municipality. So that's like 705,000 people. Greater Copenhagen is around 2 million, right? We have motorways. We did all that stuff back in the, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, ring motorways around the city. But when you live in the urban center, I mean, you know, I have a cycle track right outside my door. So does everybody else who lives on a main street. I have, you know, pretty decent bike parking wherever I go. I have a metro, 7-minute walk. I have a bus stop outside my apartment. So if I walk out of my apartment, I am presented with all these other options before I even have to think about a car, right? So it just becomes like something you don't even think about. It's like, I don't know anything about the Icelandic Cricket League because it doesn't come up in my conversation with my kids or my friends, right? Like, it's just simply, we don't even talk about it. So it's the same with cars here. You just don't talk about it. So that's what I work with, is this transport psychology. If you make the bicycle the absolute default, the fastest way from A to B, that's all that Homo sapiens have ever wanted in the history of Homo sapiens. They want to go fast from A to B. Well, not fast, right? But quick, efficient, and convenient. So the bicycle here is just simply the default.
Is that supported by street design, whether that's bike lanes or even, you know, making pedestrian-friendly streets, I imagine also translates over to having bike-friendly streets. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about that?
So every main street in Copenhagen has a physically separated cycle track, virtually, I think, every street. And the planning is a simple process. I have the easiest job in the world, man, and so do the other planners in Denmark. Michael, we need infrastructure for bikes on this street. I ask two questions. What's the speed limit for cars? Okay, and what's the volume of cars per 24 hours? Okay, and then I will choose between one of four infrastructure designs. And that is any street in the Danish kingdom, any street in any city in the world, same thing applies. So other cities are slow to realize this. They put their engineers on it to try and reinvent the wheel, and we're going, just copy paste, man. Like, it's been working for 100 years. Like, why do you even try to reinvent that? You know, we don't have cyclists in Copenhagen. We only have Copenhageners on bikes. So those people, the regular citizens, they're not going to do stuff if it's dangerous. So if they're doing it out there now, it's because it's not. Or they don't feel that it's dangerous. This sense of safety is something that the city of Copenhagen measures in their biannual bicycle report. Are we safe? Okay, number of deaths and injuries, yes. But hi, do you feel safe? Okay, you do. Okay, great. And, you know, what's your main reason for riding a bike through the city? Since 1996, people have just said, it's quick. It's fast A to B. Back to that, right? So that's really the key, man. The infrastructure network, reallocating the urban space that we gave to the automobile in the 50s and 60s all over the world, redemocratizing it, reallocating it to other transport forms, intelligent transport forms. And I don't mean smart city intelligent. I mean the bicycle, right? And pedestrianism and buses and trams, man. We invented everything we need. We don't need all this Silicon Valley gadget, you know, all those boys inventing stuff that we don't need. We got everything we need to make a really a smart city, right? The kind that was smart in 1900, not the kind that they think will be smart in 2050, right?
You touched on trams and trains there, and maybe even metro systems as well. Could you tell us a little bit more about perhaps how intermodality informs whether people are going to pick up a bike or decide to walk somewhere and how that sort of feeds into it?
I can travel all over the nation with my bike on a train, and the trains are designed for it here in the Copenhagen capital region. Absolutely. It's the most amazing system of parking on a train, like 60 bikes per train in the morning rush hour. So it's design, which we're good at in Denmark. It's really the principles of Danish design: practical, functional, elegant. Everything we need to make in Denmark or anywhere, it needs to be those three things. And we do that with the way we've designed our city for bikes, with the way we connect it up with public transport, you know, intermodality.
I want to come back as well to the ideal city. We've touched on Copenhagen. Could you maybe give us some ingredients for the ideal cycle city and then maybe the ideal transport mix in a city?
I think, like I always point out, right? I'm not a cyclist, dude. I got people on Twitter going, ah, dude, you're part of the tribe. I'm going, I am not one of your spandex tribe. Like, ride a bike. That's awesome. High five, dude. But I'm not one of you. I am just a citizen who uses a bike. It's very important, that distinction. So when we're designing a city for bikes, we're thinking about the 99%, you know, not the 1%. We're thinking about what that father or mother, you know, need to do to get around in their mobility radius, in their neighborhood with their kids, going to work, making it A to B-ism, thinking like that in transport psychology. That's really the key. And it's all down to infrastructure. There's no chicken or egg. There's only infrastructure, right? And that is reallocating the space. All the space that we've given to automobiles in our cities, I call it the arrogance of space. You know, what is a street? It's the facade to the facade, right? And if you're a city, you can do anything you want with that. So, and you have done everything with that, like the sidewalks, and, you know, have been bouncing back and forth in width, you know, in cities all over the world. And the sidewalks in New York in the 20s were like massive wide because of pedestrian volume. They designed based on the needs of the citizens then. So that's also important. So if you want people to ride a bike, you give them that safe space. You want people to walk more in their neighborhoods, you make the sidewalks wider and reduce pedestrian hazards and whatnot. So it's just really a question of redemocratizing our streets. And it's not really even nudging, you know. Nudging is a little lame communications campaign. Ride a bike, it's good for you, Nick. Ooh, yeah, you're going to save a polar bear on your bicycle today, buddy, because it's good for the environment. We all know that, but we're not going to do it for those reasons. We're going to do it if it's the fastest A to B in a city. That's it. That's all that Homo sapiens will do.
You talk as well there about, obviously, pedestrians coming first. How do they factor into your work that you've done previously? If you're designing for them first and then the bike, what's that relationship?
That's the food chain, right? Pedestrians first. Whether it's the children, you know, all the people who can't maybe drive a car in other cities, you know, in America, for example, that whole huge portion of the population, like 30, 40% who can't drive because they're a kid or they're elderly, you know, or whatever. We completely forget them in our planning. That's not democratic planning either, is when we're only designing our cities for the people with money, right? Who can afford the cafe latte, the families with kids and the professionals. That's not democratic design of a city at all. So it's important always to consider the pedestrians, because that is the spine of mobility in a city. People being able just to walk down to their local supermarket, you know, being able to walk from a train station to their office, that little last mile, man, you know, we walked before we biked in city as Homo sapiens, right? So I mean, we should really, of course, really maintain a strong pedestrian culture and provide facilities to make it like a no-brainer. But then as an extension of that, then comes bikes, because that is the fast-moving pedestrian.
Michael Colville Anderson of Copenhagenize Design Company, speaking to Monocle's Nick Manise. Now let's turn our attention to Seattle. Electrical substations are necessary for keeping the lights on, but they're almost always painful to look at. But as Monocle's Will Kitchens finds out, it doesn't always have to be that way.
When Seattle's public electric utility, Seattle City Light, proposed taking over a city street for construction of a new substation to serve the booming South Lake Union neighborhood, it had to prove to the city's design commission that it would benefit the public. The utility enlisted architecture and planning firm NBBJ to help find the answer. The result is the Denny substation, a shimmering stainless steel structure encased by an elevated linear park with a community center, a learning center, and even a dog park. All of which don't impede the substation's primary purpose, transforming high-voltage electricity into power that can be used by city buildings. To my knowledge, a substation integrating these public amenities has never been constructed, says Jose Sama, the project's lead architect. It's a one-off, he adds. Operating since 2019, the substation has become something of a community hub for pedestrians and pooches alike. The thing about civic architecture, says Sama, is that you can design and build these things, but if the community doesn't actually take a sense of stewardship, they die. While the substation's $210 million price tag raised some eyebrows, it's a worthy price to pay. And the lesson? Civic infrastructure needn't be unsightly.
Thank you, Will. And from Seattle, we venture further north into Canada and to Vancouver, where our own Thomas Lewis has been exploring how equal access to bountiful parks can be a powerful marker of a fair city. Enter VanPlay, the city's attempt to ensure that every one of its 230-odd parks is easy to reach via public transit or bicycle. Thomas spoke to Catherine Howard, a planner at the Vancouver Board of Parks and Recreation, and to Kurt Culbertson, the CEO of Design Workshop, the North California-based studio that led the consultation on VanPlay. Catherine started by explaining how the scheme became a reality.
So last year, they approved this, what we're calling a game-changing document. It's really a comprehensive citywide Parks and Recreation Services master plan. And what it does is goes beyond what a traditional master plan does, which you'd kind of assume was a set of goals and priority areas, maybe a vision statement, and then a list of things to do, kind of how you'd get to that vision in the future. VanPlay is a little bit different because it's fundamentally based in this idea of equity and access to parks and recreation for everyone. And Malcolm Bromley, the general manager of the park board, was so adamant from the very beginning. His fundamental belief is that everyone should have access to parks and recreation. And he wanted this plan to be driven by that idea. And so there was some service metrics and targets aspect that he wanted to see, like how many of things do we need and where should they be, you know, basics like that. But as we kind of dived into it and we worked with the park board commissioners, these elected officials who really reflect the concerns and the values and the dreams and aspirations of Vancouverites, it became really clear that there was something fundamentally that we needed to take on. You know, there's really this two Vancouvers thing happening. It's like there's the haves and the have-nots, and there's such big patterns emerging between the two, and we really needed to have a plan that responded to that. And that was kind of the challenge from the get-go when we first met with Kurt and we said, okay, well, we're going to take on this plan. What can we do to change some of those patterns and set ourselves up for the future?
Kurt, if I can ask you, this idea of the two Vancouvers, can you sort of outline what each Vancouver is in that idea and what that meant for what sort of public spaces or green spaces had become there for, why certain people weren't able to access them?
This issue is not unique to Vancouver. Many cities are waking up to the fact that access to parks and recreation and really other city resources are not equitably available to the entire population. And equitable, I think it's important to define as fair. It's a question of fairness, perhaps more than equal or exactly the same. And so, you know, defining that sense of fairness is a big question, but this question of spatial equity, I would call it spatial justice, is probably the biggest emerging issue in park and recreation planning and city planning in general right now. What tends to happen is, in the old days, the way park planning was often done, and you can see it in Harlan Bartholomew's original plan for Vancouver, someone would take existing parks, they would draw a walking distance radius, say 15-minute walking distance radius around the parks, and they would identify where there are gaps between all of those circles, and that presumably pointed the direction to where new parks were needed, right? A simple mapping exercise of walking distance doesn't highlight the disparities between those who have access to other forms of recreation and those who might be living with smaller lots, you know, with less landscaping around them, less tree cover, or may be living at higher density or may not have access to privatized forms of recreation. So there's a question of access, and then there's a question of differential quality. And a park, as I like to say, a green polygon on a map is not necessarily the same. You know, someone may have a brand new playground in their park or new tree plantings. Someone may have an aging playground that hasn't been renewed in 25 years. And so there's a qualitative difference across facilities, and some residents of the community have more political power, more influence. And then there's a question of inclusivity. You know, do certain segments of the population feel welcomed in the park, or does pricing of activities and so forth create barriers to access, right? And so that condition certainly exists in Vancouver. It exists really in every city in North America, if not every city in the world. But I think because of the really rapid growth of Vancouver, the densification of the city, the problem is particularly acute in Vancouver.
Stanley Park is obviously a magnificent space, but I suppose not all of Vancouver's kind of green public spaces are on the sort of scale. I'm guessing, like in many cities around the world, you know, green spaces can sort of iterate themselves in lots of different ways, different sizes, different scales. Are there any sort of bits of the city that are sort of being reinvigorated in some way by this growth?
It's actually fairly interesting, that phenomenon. Vancouver, like many other cities, but quite distinctly, our park development capital funds that we spend on developing new parks and renewing existing parks to help them respond to changing population need and growth, all of that funding comes from developer contributions, community amenity contributions from development, from rezoning applications and things like that. A huge proportion of the budget is from those sorts of developments. So it actually works incredibly well to support where populations are changing. Where we get a lot more density, we get a lot more money to spend on parks. And so we've been able to respond quite quickly in those areas to provide interesting, new, more resilient park spaces that can cater for more population. Actually, what's been fascinating and where VanPlay really targets is those parts of the city that are not subject to growth. And what's happened in those areas is that because there's no money coming in to support renewal, the infrastructure's aging, the community centres are all due for renewal, they're getting up to critical condition, the parks are overused and overloved and loved to death. Because there isn't the money to spend in those geographic areas as quickly and easily. And so that's something that the equity work through VanPlay has, you know, shone a light on and allowed us to act on really clearly and transparently, that that's what we're taking on, that that disparity is happening.
The city planner, Catherine Howard, and the CEO of Design Workshop, Kurt Culbertson, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. Now, time for us to join Monocle's Ed Stocker as he turns his focus to Quito to tell us how a new metro is helping to reconnect the city and is offering a chance to transform it.
It's not easy to build transport links from scratch, but in Ecuador's capital, Quito, authorities have charted an underground route that brings the Andean metropolis, known for its historic colonial centre, firmly into the 21st century. Construction began in 2016 and the metro is set to open in January next year, linking El Labrador in the north with Quitumbe in the south in just 34 minutes. The quickest time to take that route currently on public transport is 2 hours. How the city rethinks the metro as the backbone for larger urban transformations will define its success over time, says Ecuadorian urbanist and architect Felipe Correa. The careful insertion of inner city affordable housing, the introduction of social services, updating and expanding educational facilities, and the introduction of new recreational hubs, among other projects, should be conceived and designed in relation to the urban spine established by the metro line. But Quito isn't stopping there. Despite being a long, challenging 2,850 metres above sea level, the city is also adamant on further developing its cycling infrastructure, aiming for 5% of all journeys to be made by bike by 2025. It is also hoping to add electric buses to its fleet and considering a cable car system. Quito, it seems, just wants to keep moving. For Monocle, I'm Ed Stocker.
Now, as we've learned through the years of covering urbanism and the cities that we call home, to build a community that is welcoming and a great place to live, everything from the quality of the shops to the height of the buildings needs to be considered, and even how our parks might connect to other green spaces in the city. To unpack exactly how this could and should look, and for some Antipodean examples, we heard from Helen Lockheed, a dean at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and president of the Australian Institute of Architects. Let's have a listen.
I know in Sydney, for example, and I really can only speak about Sydney with any degree of authority, we've really been working on the ideal of a 30-minute city where everyone would be able to have all their needs met within a 30-minute radius. But I think the city has really become the 5-minute city, the 5-minute neighbourhood, the 5-minute village. It's amazing how one can constrain one's life and one's footprint to a very small geography when all your needs are met. You know, when you think about good places, they do have a corner store and they do have a local cafe or bar or whatever. And those things are within a walking distance. And you do have a little pocket park for little kids or for older people to go out and watch the little kids. The difference is in new parts of the city, we don't always have that. And I think there is an acknowledgement and an awareness that that's required. It's just a bit more difficult to actually achieve that. But I also think we can't just rely on little bits of interstitial open space. You do have to have generous lungs of the city kind of open space, like the Central Park, the places where you can connect with trees and green and wildlife, not just a playground for a kid. There's plenty of playgrounds for kids in New York City and they've got fences around them and tarmac, and that's not a great place for people, you know. So I do think you do need to have a sense of the ecosystem of the city in which you live. So I think the idea of green and blue corridors, you know, acknowledging the hydrology, acknowledging those gullies and creeks, and we have a lot of that in Sydney, but we've annihilated it to the west of the city. So we need to actually bring the geography of place to the fore and acknowledge that those ecosystems, whether they're blue as in waterways or green as in natural systems, and reinforce that through the new places we make, you know, whether it's a grid of trees or, you know, a cycleway, which is along a greenway or a river or a creek. I think all these things actually make for the good fundamentals of place, because you understand the place in which you live. And then you can intersperse that with development, which is at varying densities, depending on how close you are to that amenity. You know, if you're a 10-minute walk, you might need more space in your own backyard. Whereas if you're right on that park, Central Park or whatever the equivalent may be, or Sydney Harbour, you can have much higher density because you've got so much more shared amenity that you can tap into. So I think those sorts of structural issues help to make a good place. And if you think about memorable places, they do have great quality of built environment and great public domain and great mixes of uses and great public transport. And public transport includes active transport, includes walkable streets and cycling streets, as well as good metros and light rail and all those things where you can hop on and hop off quickly and easily and remain connected to the larger metropolis. And you need to have jobs close to those as well. And I think when you talk about the built form and the future of the built form, if you had walk-up buildings like you do in so many parts of Europe and more established cities older than ours, they don't fall apart when the lift doesn't work, or you just walk up the stairs, you know, and you manage it. And you can still maintain, you know, amenity where you can call down to the streets or come out onto your balcony. You can still have that higher density, but the occupation of spacious private domain and generous public domain in a more equitable manner, you know, as opposed to high rise. I always use the old lady with the cat on her lap rule, which is really how you design a good apartment, is that there's got to be some place for someone who's not very mobile to be able to sit in the sun with the cat on their lap or the newspaper or a book or whatever, because they're the people who really don't have a choice about whether they go to the bar or the cafe or the park or get on the train and go to the beach or whatever. So high density living needs to have that person in mind. I do think, you know, when you talk about, well, what's density or what kind of built form, I think, for example, I mean, I prefer a high density environment. I live right close to King's Cross in Sydney, but I live in a little row house. So I live really close to everything, but I still have my own little courtyard space. But I'd also be quite happy to live in an apartment with a balcony. So I just think you need that, especially in our climate, you need that ability to step outside onto a balcony. But I also think we're not going to change cities like Perth or Sydney or Singapore or whatever overnight. And we have to think about, well, how we retrofit it. And I think, you know, places like Singapore have completely retrofitted themselves in terms of green infrastructure and enhancing livability. When you look at even places like Shanghai, I think, you know, they built 500 metro stops and, you know, they can roll out trees like their carpet. So we can improve our lot that we have. We are social beings, and the glue that keeps communities together is the public domain. That is where we all interact. That's where we all are the same, whether we're old or young or poor or rich. We're all pedestrians at the end of the day, whether we can't get out of a limo or we don't have a limo or we get the bus. So it has to be of a quality and accessibility and amenity that suits all those people all the time. So you do have to have a public domain which is genuinely public, not a right of way which might be closed off at night or might be owned by a developer, but you can walk through it only if we like you, or a mall which you can use only if we like you, but we can kick you out if we don't like the cut of your jib. So I do think the first thing is public domain needs to be public. And it needs to be equitable, and we need to have enough of it. And the reason why is because the public domain is the only thing that remains intact. You know, development comes and goes. The city of London doesn't look like the city of the 16th century or even the 18th century, and it won't look the same as the 22nd century city. But the public domain, the rivers, the bridges, the streets, the major avenues and boulevards, and those parks, those incredible parks, have really been there for a long, long time. So if we want to keep the city we want in the future, it needs to be able to adapt to change in terms of building innovation and building needs and changes in the way we work and live. And we don't even know the technologies we'll have at our fingertips in the future. But the public domain, where we all come together because we're physical beings, needs to be intact in perpetuity. And that's why we need to invest in it.
That was Helen Lockheed, who's a dean at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and president of the Australian Institute of Architects. Well, that's just a snapshot of a few of the projects that are featured in the July-August issue of Monocle. Have a look, because there are many, many more great ideas in there. We head to Delhi to see a new park that's been built there. And we head to Nairobi to meet two women who've been leading the charge to revitalise the city's libraries and make them into something more contemporary and useful for the citizens of that city. It's a great roundup of all sorts of projects. And to be honest, it was kind of nice to lift our gaze from the world of COVID for a few days and to think about schemes that have been planned for ages and are coming to fruition now. It's a good reminder that other things will happen in our cities, and it's time to start planning their future in really kind of ambitious ways. So the July-August issue is on newsstands now, or of course you can buy it from monocle.com. But that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's CeeLo Green with Bright Lights, Bigger City. Thank you for listening, city lovers. And it's all right.